Well, it was billed as one day to save the world. This morning, the G20 has been and gone, and the world still seems to be here. I am Allegra Stratton, and we'll use this special edition of Politics Weekly to figure out whether it lived up to the billing.
And I'm Tom Clark, and joining us to pour over the aftermath of the Great Jamboree, we have our economics guru, Larry Elliott, and our premier political pundit, Jonathan Friedland.
Hello.
Hi.
We saw the power touch this week. What's the power touch, Larry?
What is the power touch?
The power touch is the Obama hand on the back of Gordon and the Michelle Obama hand round the waist of the Queen.
Oh, right. No, God, I didn't know that. No, that's completely new to me. I'm just an economics guru.
Does it work?
This sort of stuff. I'm just a number cruncher and a boring nerd.
Me, an economics guru.
Does the power touch work?
Well, it's a repeat body language formulation. I mean, it's not new. Do you remember Bush always used to put the hand on Blair? I always thought belittling Blair a bit, reducing Blair. Clinton used to do the hand at the mid lower back and then smoothing it up. He does this with men. He moves the hand
body
up
touch formulation.
The
that
back.
Sounds like Gus Hedges dropped a dead donkey.
It's not new body language, so it does imply. I always think it's friendly. But a touch of condescension. It says that you're, you know, well done, young man.
I find it a touching business. Well, they only had 7 hours together, but Gordon and Brown emerged at the end of the day looking pretty pleased about what he's achieved.
This is the day that the world came together to fight back against the global recession. Not with words, but with a plan for global recovery and for reform.
So, Larry, the words were warm, but what solid three things would you pick out of the mix?
Well, I think the first thing is the action on tax havens, the naming and shaming of tax havens. That's good. It doesn't quite go far enough yet, because I think what we really need is an automatic process whereby tax havens have to give up the information without being asked for it, without actually having to go through a huge rigmarole. I thought the re-regulation stuff of the banking system was tough and solid and meaty. There was more on clamping down on bankers' pay than I thought there would be. There was stuff on hedge funds, which I welcome. So there was some good stuff there. I give half a cheer for the IMF package, where essentially the IMF has been given the resources to bail out countries that get into trouble. At the moment, it hasn't really got enough firepower, and that's been trebled so that it can ride to the rescue of countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, who are teetering on the brink. Only half a cheer, because the extra money for the fund hasn't really come with any major reform, and I think that's needed too.
Johnny, it's a sort of new global consensus. I sound like Gordon Brown, but it was a big group hug.
Yes, I mean, I think the way to think about this is just imagine if it had gone the other way, and
right,
if
yeah.
there had been either at the most dramatic end, and I agree this probably wasn't likely, but if there had been a walkout as threatened by Sarkozy, or if there had been a very, very bland communique.
There's never going to be a walkout.
No, that's what I mean. I mean, but something 2 degrees less than that, some kind of obvious falling out or failure to agree. Or probably the way it would have worked out if there had been a failure, a very bland communique with really nothing in it, no figures at all for Larry to talk about or digest. Now, if that had happened, we'd all be saying this was absolutely Brown's failure. He took ownership of this summit in a way more than most country hosts do, I think, for previous summits. It became his. He had done all the advance work, travelling the globe, going even the extra 10,000 miles to Chile last week, in the previous week. So therefore, we know what we'd have said about this if this had gone the other way. So we can mock the language of New World Order, a phrase actually which I think was inept in some ways, because it has a completely different meaning and a very negative meaning in the United States. So he should have avoided that. But we can mock that rhetoric. And yet, the fact that he got these big people together with an agreement with some substance in it counts as really quite a major achievement, if only because we know the reverse would have been quite a major failure.
That's absolutely right. And the 1.1 trillion was quite important for the financial markets, because they actually boomed straight after the summit ended. And I think they were impressed by that number and by the feeling that it had been a success.
But Larry, wasn't the one thing that this summit was meant to do, if we look back 6 weeks or a couple of months, that we're talking about an agreement on a fiscal stimulus, new government borrowing, tax cuts, or a Green New Deal or whatever. Now, that wasn't really there, was it?
No, and I don't think it was ever going to be there, because the Germans and the French have been strongly opposed to taking any further action to boost the world economy until they can see what effect all the previous lots of packages are going to have. And I think that's quite sensible, actually. I don't actually think they should be increasing the amount of stimulus at the moment. Policy is already incredibly loose. So I think that the German and French position was actually quite sensible. And their line was, well, we need to repair the some of the problems which caused the crisis in the first place before we actually start to think about boosting the economy through tax cuts or through spending increases. I think the German and the French approach was actually quite vindicated by the summit outcome.
Can we just come back to the IMF for a minute? It's not that long since people were talking about abolishing it, and it's also not that long since it was seen in previous debt crises as the villain of the piece. Is it going to be different, Larry, this time?
Well, I think that is one of the big problems, that the IMF is now back and it's big. And some people say it's big and it's back and it's badder than ever, because it's still going to have the potential to go into countries and actually set conditions for the loans. There was some talk yesterday. Douglas Alexander was talking this week about actually, you know, changing the conditionality and making the conditions for poor countries less onerous. But I wonder whether that's actually going to happen. I think that in some ways, the only part of the world where the old Washington consensus of liberalisation and privatisation is going to persist is in poor countries. And just as in the West, we are talking about re-regulating our banking systems and going back to a more traditional model of banking, that model may be imposed on poor countries. That if that happens, that'd be an absolute disaster.
Well, that's why I thought it was so important that he used that sentence, again, heavily misunderstood by the American press, that the Washington consensus is now over. I thought it was an amazingly big statement to make. Now, most of the people in Larry's field understood that phrase and understood exactly what it meant, that it referred to the policy pursued by international institutions like the IMF and like the World Bank. There were several members of the travelling White House press corps who thought this was an extraordinary diss of them and of American policy and the United States administrations, not getting the IMF to mention. They asked it of Obama twice. To them, this was in a way like the misunderstanding about special relationship being downgraded to special partnership. What does this mean? The trumpet declaration from the host of this summit has come in and said, as they understood it, Washington no longer rules the roost. That was a misunderstanding. It was referring specifically to an old model of the IMF and the World Bank. And it was that, I think, that Brown was saying is over. And now that that sentence is out there, surely he can be held to that, even as far as the poorer countries are concerned. People can say, look, you've said that isn't the approach anymore.
It should be held to it. I mean, and I think I think in some ways the Washington consensus is over in a more meaningful sense, in that the fact that we've now got the G20, and some people talk about a G2 within the G20, the US and China, means that the 20-year Washington consensus, the sort of unipolar, US-dominated, Anglo-Saxon model of globalisation, that, I think, is over. I think that what we are now seeing is the sort of change in the balance of global balance of power. That's one of the big, big changes that we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years.
Well, it's one of the hardest things that the organisers had to do yesterday was get 20 people together for a group photo. They struggled, and indeed, Canadian PM was actually on the loo for one of the attempts. Well, for a better snapshot of the G20 from around the world, we asked three of our correspondents for a quick take.
I'm Angelique Chrysaphis, The Guardian's Paris correspondent. Well, Nicolas Sarkozy is claiming victory this morning, saying his determination at the G20 secured a profound reform of the world system, that it's the dawn of a new, more moral capitalism. The question for Sarkozy is, how does this translate at home? Now, France has a rigorous banking system and social protection. It has not suffered the banking crisis of Britain or Ireland, and it hasn't seen the property collapse of Spain. But the private sector is weak, and France is going to take longer than other countries to come out of the crisis at the other end. Now, Sarkozy has always said the crisis was the Anglo-Saxons' fault. Now, this means that Britain and the US, their model of unbridled excess, speculation and greed, sparked the whole problem in the first place. Now, the French public, of course, deeply mistrusts globalisation and free market economics. And the question this morning in France is, have the Anglo-Saxons won? Now, there's a feeling that the financial centre of gravity is heading east, that China has more say, and that after the meeting in London, there's at least a little more regulation to temper that Anglo-Saxon model. So the mood is cautiously optimistic.
I'm Tanya Branigan, The Guardian's China correspondent. Gordon Brown boasted yesterday that Beijing would contribute another $40 billion to the IMF. But it's really not getting much play over here. In fact, the reams of coverage in the official media barely mention the boost. It's not clear what form the extra funding will take, but most believe that, in the long run, at least, more money has to mean a greater say. And that's what this has been about for China. In truth, they never expected this meeting to be epoch-defining. It's more about shaping the long-term agenda and reinforcing the growing clout of the world's third largest economy. And for now, China's seen off France's bid to include the special administrative regions of Hong Kong and Macau in a tax haven blacklist. They're due to be included eventually, but Beijing will still be relieved by the current exemption after the biggest row of the summit.
I'm Tom Parfit, The Guardian's correspondent in Moscow.
Well, President Medvedev has certainly spoken very positively about his meeting with Obama. He called the US president his new comrade. And the two leaders' agreement to seek to reduce strategic nuclear warheads has been greeted warmly here in Russia, both as a positive step in improving ties and also as a strategic coup, considering Moscow has a more outdated arsenal than the US. As for the overall summit outcomes of the G20, the Kremlin has given them a cautious welcome, calling them a step in the right direction. But I do think that President Medvedev will be personally disappointed that delegates rejected his suggestion to discuss setting up a new international reserve currency to rival the dollar.
Johnny, you were surprised. You didn't know that Medvedev had called Obama his comrade.
No, I hadn't picked that up, and I like that. I mean, we deconstruct all this language. Each country does it. I mentioned this point about the umbrage that many in the British press took at this phrase "special partnership" rather than "special relationship," and I think Obama
Dodge
deliberately
presents too.
The DVD gate, the notion of giving sort of Police Academy 2 as
but
a
also that
as a
they
present.
Were Region 1 DVDs. You couldn't,
so you couldn't even play. I think we all have multi-region players now in this day and age. Certainly Brownwood, he's a big Americanophile. But this seems to me the Russian equivalent of using a phrase like "special relationship." I don't know the Russian word, but if I'm sure Tom Parfit's right that he used this word comrade, and that's a very interesting term. I think that's one of the big stories out of the summit. And a big story about Obama, this notion of an agreement about reducing nuclear arsenals. One of the things that Obama has said, even when he was a candidate, and it's barely got the attention it deserves, he says it over and over again, not just to reduce, he uses the phrase rid the world of nuclear weapons. Now, it's a most radical policy. It's been in there early. He said it in his Berlin speech in July, and he says it, said it in his convention speech. And people don't really make a big deal of it because they think, well, obviously, that's never going to happen. But he does keep saying it. And the fact that he brought it up in his first ever meeting and not just brought it up, got an agreement, makes you think maybe this is on his agenda.
Was it that reset button that was working?
And this time they gave it the right name now, didn't they? And that poor old Hillary got in
trouble.
Story,
just to explain to the listeners, the reset button where Hillary gave to her Russian counterpart the button saying reset in Russian, except it didn't say reset, it said what, Johnny? Overcharge.
That's right. That's right. Which is sort of appropriate in our global financial banking era.
One thing I'm sort of struck by listening to those three clips is that every country's got very much its own take on what's happened yesterday. And in a way, the fact that we had the G20, India and China coming along with the normal kind of rich man's club of the G7. That in itself, I think, backs up your argument before about the rest of the world maybe not dancing to Washington's tune as much as they have in the past.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it started sort of earlier in this decade with the trade talks when India, China and Brazil formed a bloc and absolutely held up the normal sort of progress, which is that the EU and the US cut a deal and everybody else agrees to it. That's now over in terms of the trade talks, and I think that's actually started to filter through into bigger international meetings. When the G8 started as the rich man's club, and gradually they've sort of introduce country club members, sort of China and India are allowed to go along to some of the sessions. And it's pretty obvious that wasn't working either, because some of the big issues of today, global financial markets, international currency movements, oil prices, require the big developing countries. It's pointless actually trying to have a deal about the global economy now without Saudi Arabia, without India, without China, without Brazil. So, to have this new forum with 20 countries rather than 8 absolutely makes sense, and I think that is obviously the future. The G20 is the future and the G8 is the past. I can't see much future for the G8, to be honest.
Well, every country might have its own spin, but what none disputes is that the man in the middle of it all was President Barack Obama. Michael Tomasky reports on how he performed.
President Obama probably accomplished everything he needed to accomplish in his role at the G20 summit. I think there were basically three things that he needed to do. First, just on the symbolic level, he needed to come over to London, represent the United States of America, he and his wife, represent the country, not do anything foolish or stupid, and look like the guy who was the leader of the world, the leader of this group of 20 or 22 world leaders. And I think to most American eyes, I think he did that. I think the second thing he needed to do was that he needed this package of reforms to be in the ballpark of what he wanted them to be, what his administration was touting. And I think that was probably accomplished to enough of an extent that it should be a good thing for him politically. The regulations on hedge funds and banks are very in line with what Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner announced before Obama went over. The money for the International Monetary Fund and the special drawing rights credits that will be extended to smaller countries, impoverished countries. These were things that the Obama administration said were going to be goals. The third thing, to be very blunt about it, is that he had to not lose a PR war with Sarkozy. Americans have a special kind of antagonism and thing about France. If it had been seen that Sarkozy defeated Obama, quote-unquote, on that thing about the international regulator, that would have been a PR problem or possibly even disaster for Obama. So that was avoided. It's very interesting that politically Obama just seems to keep picking up steam here in the States. There was a little dip in his approval rating a couple of weeks ago. From everything I've seen now in the past 7 to 10 days, it's gone back up. He was at 69% in one poll earlier this week, and I think it'll go up even farther. So I think this helps his position as he comes back to Washington and has to enmesh himself tooth and nail in this budget fight. There will be a lot of opposition. It'll come not only from Republicans, but also from moderate Democrats. And, people aren't just going to roll over and play dead just because he had a good few days in London. But certainly the momentum is going to help strengthen his hand for those fights.
Johnny, liberal Americans like Mike Tomasky might be excited by the summit, but does middle America really care?
No, it's the same problem that any domestic politician will have, which is it's all fine doing well on the world stage, but it's got to deliver for your domestic constituency. And people will be asking of the president the same question that we heard at those press conferences, which is, this is all fine, but what will it do for jobs and for homes and very bread and butter stuff domestically? And he has a job on his hands, and they all do, to explain how these quite abstract and rarefied terms, special drawing rights and institutions like the IMF, how they are going to give people jobs in Peoria, Illinois, and that's his challenge. And I thought they were struggling a bit, actually, in their closing press conferences. Obama was, Brown was, to really explain that, to nail that. It's quite an abstract case, which centres essentially on saying, well, none of us are going to recover if the world economy itself doesn't recover. And that's quite a difficult argument to make. It's not as literal as saying, here's some money and I'm going to invest it in a job creation programme in Michigan. On the other point, I think it's true that one of the big things of having in a position if you like Obama's is you just have to seem presidential. And that can really hobble you if you struggle with that. I mean, Clinton had big problems with that in his first year or two because people wondered whether he was presidential enough on the world stage. And Obama has cleared that hurdle and he did impress. I think it's interesting, this point about Sarkozy, because in a way Sarkozy would say he didn't lose to Obama in that battle. I mean, he got a very stringent and tough language on tax haven. So that's a battle of spin about who's won that. But in a way, I suppose if you're Gordon Brown and you're the host, you're looking back and thinking, if all these people are trying to claim ownership and paternity of this summit, it shows you as a success, because God knows they would all be fleeing from it if it had been a failure.
See ya. Larry, the New York Times this morning was saying mixed results was their verdict. That in particular, they were angry, nothing on toxic assets for banks.
Yeah, there wasn't much on toxic assets. I mean, what they said was that they'd have a common approach, which is summit language, really, for that we'll all do our own thing, but under some sort of overarching theological view of the toxic assets. I don't really think that actually policymakers have yet got to grips with toxic assets. I mean, that's the reality, that they don't yet know just how much of this poison is lurking around in the global banking system, but they're sort of committed to doing something about it jointly, even if that means jointly, but in their own way. So I think that I think the New York Times is right to be slightly sceptical about that part of the package.
Johnny, do you think, like, all these economic problems Larry's talking about, the downturn, it's clearly preoccupying people in America a lot, but is that getting in the way of Obama's domestic reform agenda, healthcare and all of that sort of thing? Or is he getting on with the job and, in the words of his chief of staff, wasn't it, not wasting a good crisis, pushing this stuff through at the same time?
Well, the line about not wasting a good crisis was very much in my mind watching the end of the summit, because one of the things that that I think people are disappointed by, and some people thought the summit might be used for, was the green dimension and climate change. Now, one of Obama's signature promises in the campaign was to link these things together, the climate crisis and the financial crisis, and say that the solution is common. The way you'll get out of this is by a whole lot of spending to re-equip the American economy to be low carbon. And that wasn't in there, really, in a strong way, in the communique. And it goes to a larger point about Obama, which is he's finding, I think, what all presidents is, and administrations do all say, which is, in the end, you can really only do one thing at a time. There's just that much political capital. And, you know, unlike many other leaders, including Brown, Obama does always have this Congress to drive things through. I mean, that even inhibited, I think, some of the things that the G20 themselves could do. He has to get everything through and get everything ratified. And that's always an obstacle. And so, for example, healthcare one of his, you know, largest proposals that can move to universal healthcare. He tried to get it inside the budget. But what people are beginning to say, from what I've been reading, is the moment may come where Congress essentially says, you've got to choose what your priorities are, and something is going to have to be postponed into the next year or the year after, which, you know, given the rhythms of the American political calendar and election time, may mean it gets postponed into a second term. And that moment may be approaching in a few months' time, where he essentially has to start shedding goals, the green stuff, healthcare, whatever it is, big plans on education, and just maybe focus all his energies on just getting the American economy going. He'd be very reluctant to make that move because he's always thought they're interrelated.
Johnny there talking about a US election, but we will have a UK election before the next US election. Obama is popularly thought to have snubbed Brown in January when Brown visited. Was he making up yesterday?
I think he did want to make up for it. The snub thing is interesting because some people believe that because of the DVDs and everything, and the fact they didn't get a full press conference.
Yeah, just a spray.
I mean, he still managed to be the first European leader into the White House. That mattered in terms of the competition and rivalry with Sarkozy. And then he won this massive prize, really, of getting the first overseas visit here for the summit. But I did wonder if there was a bit of overcompensation going on in the language. I thought it was very pointed that Brown used the phrase special relationship. I think somebody, State Department people had briefed him and said, you just need to get those words out of your mouth to get the British press off your back, because otherwise they're just going to do this theological study of the meaning of special partnership. I'm told by people in Washington, they thought special partnership was an elevation, was an enhanced, was even stronger, because a partnership is almost like, you know, in your life you have relationships with lots of people, but you only have one partner. And also it suggests you're going to do things together. So they thought it was a great compliment. Nevertheless, the British press in particular are fetishistic about this phrase, special relationship. So Obama said that. He said he's my friend, which is an important level, because I remember it was a big moment when Tony Blair said about Bill Clinton, I'm proud to call him friend. And it's just got a whole diplomatic extra parlance. And also I thought even the stuff, the banter about dinosaurs and everything. You know, I'm wondering, there was the Colgate summit in incredibly embarrassing, excruciating moment with Blair in the ball-huggingly tight trousers, where he said, you know, what do we have in common? And Bush said, we use the same toothpaste. I thought Obama very deliberately was saying, we've got this very human thing in common, young kids, and it was very sweet. And I think he went overboard to make sure no one will say there's anything but amity between these two.
But Brown yesterday, nor could Obama, they couldn't answer the question on jobs. What does it mean in their respective domestic... What does it mean for jobs in this country?
The summit?
Yeah.
Diddly squat, I thought. You know, they can't do, can
it? Is it a fair question to ask?
It's a fair question, but the fact is, I mean, that I don't expect any short-term benefit from this summit. This is a long-term thing, really. I mean,
it's not the danger that it delivers after an election, I think
probably the politicians are wrong to give the impression that there is some short-term fix here. This is a long-term, long-burn solution.
And that mismatch between short-term glitz and long-term results is pretty dangerous for Gordon Brown, isn't it, Jonathan?
Massively. I think that those are the two big problems I think he has, that the case itself is a difficult one to make about the connection between summitry and bread and butter in people's lives. But also the time span is just totally ill-suited to him. Obama can live with it in a way, because maybe it does feed out results in 2011 or 2012. That's fine for him in re-election in November 2012. It may work. Gordon Brown is on a completely different calendar.
Gordon is running out of time, and that's why he's so desperate to get some fiscal stimulus and get the economy moving. I mean, there are two points in this, really, and I think that the good thing about yesterday politically for Brown is that it actually vindicates the idea that he is a politician of the progressive left, and that's to that wing of politics that we need to look for some solutions, that the crisis has actually validated that form of social democracy, regulating markets,
cooperation,
being active in the economy rather than just leaving things to the market. So the subliminal message is you have to trust people like me, people like Obama, to do this sort of stuff. And if they can get some sign of economic recovery by the end of this year, then that will be good for Brown, I think. I think his view, and I don't resolve from it, is that he can still win this election, but it requires some sign that these policies are starting to pay off. And then he will be able to highlight the fact that the other lot didn't actually support most of these policies and are untested and untried, and the policies he was bold enough to try did work. And I think that might not be a particularly bad message, but it does require some results pretty quickly.
So Cameron getting on the box about an hour after the summit finished, saying, you know, this is irrelevant. Good or bad move on his part? I mean, this time last week, Tories were saying, you know, Mervyn King et al. Have vindicated us.
Yes, I mean, they're in a position, I think, where they can only do opposition, because if they just cheerlead, then what's the point of them? Yeah. So they have to do this kind of opposition. And in a way, Cameron did the obvious thing, which is say, yeah, but in a way, a version of what we've all been saying, which is fine, this is all well and good, but it's not going to change anything now. And in a way, he has truth on his side with that. But the difficulty for him politically, Cameron, is if he does seem as if he is against what is now an absolute global trend and consensus, if he's on the wrong side of that argument about tougher regulation, etc. It's an odd thing, because there was something both left and right, if you like, in this. And where does Cameron position himself? Because he wants to be, you know, simultaneously echoing what was the Sarkozy-Merkel position about scepticism towards a stimulus, and that's in some ways a traditional right-wing position. No, the government shouldn't spend too much. But then on the other hand, you have Sarkozy and Merkel saying, but we want very, very tight regulation. That is not traditional Tory ground. So it's difficult for him about exactly where to put himself. I think what Brown wanted from this is for voters to look at those pictures and say, you know what, I cannot see David Cameron in that position. I cannot imagine him. Yes, I can picture him hosting and patting on the back with Obama.
You're sighing,
but I cannot picture him having convened all these people and really steered this thing through. And the reason why I was thinking to myself, is it plausible they'll think that? And the reason why I think it might be plausible is I'm not even sure I can imagine Tony Blair having done what Gordon Brown did. This was Gordon Brown's moment. This is, in a way, what he was made for. He gets economics. Yeah. He understands the world system.
Gordon loves summits. Gordon really, really, really loves summits.
No, he was here.
He's been like a kid at Christmas, hasn't he, all week? I mean, he really regretted the fact that in 2005, when he did a lot of the donkey work for Ben Eagles, that he wasn't there. And one of his entourage said it was Hamlet without the prince. Well, yesterday, he was Hamlet. I mean, he loved it. He was glorying in it. And, you know, fair dues to him. Does do good summits. I mean, he is a good.
But also, this is his. It's not just the summitry. It is global financial architecture. This
macro.
Is a guy who could talk about this for 20 hours without getting a glass of water. You know, he loves this stuff.
He was
steeped in it. But also, in a way, I do think that this was the moment where you know, cometh the hour, cometh the man. He was the world kind of did need somebody who gets all this stuff in his head, who corralled everyone. You know, this is not just journalists. It's been, you saw the Dutch Prime Minister saying yesterday he chaired the meeting, Brown, very, very effectively, and even inspired people around the table. Now, that will come as news to many of Brown's own cabinet, that he can inspire people around the table. Yeah. But in this one area, this is what he's made for.
The
and
question,
I think Brown wants people to think Cameron couldn't have done that.
The question of whether people can imagine Cameron in that spot, and sort of just makes me think, the reason I was sighing, it makes me think really of, you know, Jim Callaghan back in the late 1970s, where people used to think, my God, could we actually imagine that ghastly woman ever being prime minister? The fact was that the economic situation was so desperate in the winter of 78-79 that, you know, the fact she was untried, the fact that she was a woman, which was obviously a bigger thing then than it would be now, meant that people just voted for her because they were so fed up with Labour. And I think that's why things have to come good for Labour economically in order for that mood music, the idea of Gordon, the global statesman, to have any real traction.
Completely right. My point was only they already can imagine Cameron as prime minister. The point is, can they imagine him steering us through the economic storm? That's a different question.
Well, that has to be it for us from today. On a day when we learnt that there was a new form of capitalism because Sir Fred Goodwin might give back some of his pension. Thanks to Jonathan Friedland and Larry Elliott for coming into the studio, and to Francesca Panetta for producing the show.
There's no programme now for 2 weeks as it's Easter, but we'll be back on the 23rd with Georgina Henry and Jackie Ashley to pick apart that political week. It's the budget that week.
Until then, goodbye.